Why are the Irish people being replaced?
Yes! Yes.
Why are we being forced into a status as second-class citizens in our own country? Why is the very concept of home ownership, a fundamental requirement to protection of a functioning democracy, being denied to Irish and only to Irish people?
Yes.
Why are the Irish forced to deny a roof over their heads for their own children when criminal gangs, con men from every corner of the globe, and military-aged so-called refugees who couldn't join the Ukraine on our bus for being imported into our country with the deliberate intent of causing social instability and unrest and providing a voting bloc for our left-wing parties? It is time for the Irish people to realise that not only does your government not serve your interests, but it genuinely despises its own people and it despises this great historic nation. Any party, any political and judicial system, any government which places the interests of the European Union, the corrupt Ukrainian government, the WHO or the UN ahead of the interests of Ireland must at this stage be regarded as the enemy of the Irish people.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Gemma O'Doherty on the show. She is an award-winning journalist, an Irish award-winning journalist. She has started her career to exposing the corruption in her native land or homeland. She's also the editor of the Irish Light, a paper, an actual newspaper.
Hi, Timothy. Great to talk to you. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. Anything you want to add to that intro? Is that sufficient?
Yes, well, the Irish Light is a new paper that we started about a year ago in conjunction with the UK version of the Light. I have to say we have a big American following. We don't actually post it to America, but a lot of people over there have shown an interest in it because it's a no-holds-barred paper.
And this, the, I guess the impetus for this publication was it the COVID craziness?
It was. And I had wanted to go back to newspaper journalism. And I had worked in the biggest paper in Ireland for nearly 20 years and had been exposing an awful lot of corruption. And the biggest Irish donor to the Clintons bought the paper. And he basically, Dennis O'Brien is his name, and he came in and said he didn't want any awkward journalists, you know, writing about corruption in the state. So I was told basically to go on gardening duty or, you know, so I said I'd see him in court. So I sued him and I won my case. So that gave me the opportunity basically to, you know, do my work independently. And that's why we started the Irish Light.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure that'll fill an important, well, an obvious void in journalism, real investigative journalism. We don't really have that anymore. I don't know if we ever had it really, but we did have some examples of it in the past. It's gotten a lot worse. The press have always been kind of, at least here in the state, I can speak to the United States, is you know, with Mockingbird, CIA, it's always been under control of the oligarchs. It's, you know, free press if you're rich enough to own a paper or a radio station or television network or something. But that's a whole other issue.
I know. It's shocking. Although, really, like, investigative journalism doesn't cost that much. And, you know, there's this perception that you need teams and teams of people. But in fact, you know, I don't agree. You know, really, you can establish a lot as one person. And, you know, we get 20,000 copies printed most months, and it costs about 2,000 euros, you know, pretty much same in dollars. So, and people are so generous, you know, they want to support it. So it's, you know, it's actually, it's not really, it is very doable. You know, I'm delighted that we have something in print, something tangible that people can sit down and read, and, you know, we can leave around public places like buses and hospitals and universities, and hopefully open a few minds.
Yeah, that's interesting, because obviously the truth isn't that expensive. Lying is expensive because you have to maintain this whole edifice of lies and deceits that really does take trillions of dollars. truth is not expensive, and it shall set you free. It may not get you rich, but it will set you free. It is obvious that, given the fact that how much pressure they've had to bring to bear and shutting people down, like depriving them of payment services, you know, like with PayPal and these things. So they've been, initially people were using that to finance their investigative journalism, their internet, operation, their podcasts, and they shut it all down. Same with publications, how, you know, Amazon has to ban books and these things. And yeah, you're right. So there are, if the oligarchs were really dedicated to free speech, and free press, they'd have a lot more competition. And I guess you could say investigative journalism is very expensive if it exposes your corruption and you lose your power because of it.
Yes. Yeah. Like, Timothy, I've been banned absolutely everywhere. You know, obviously YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. I'm back on Twitter, but not with my big account. So this is a way that this, you know, the establishment in Ireland, which is very, very obsessed with far-right nonsense and all of that, they can't control this. And it really frightens them because, you know, we have our own distribution channels. We have great people going door to door, getting this information into people's letterboxes. And, you know, we could do thousands of homes in one morning. And, you know, we really feel like it's the old fashioned methods are often the best. So it's working really well, and there's nothing that the state can do about it.
Yep. That's why they're fighting back with law, hate speech laws and these things. Now, Ireland right now, it's going through a very similar, perhaps more acute, given its relative size, very relatively small population, island nation. It's under a lot of demographic pressure for some reason. It's been designated an island nation for refugees. We can get into that. What's going on there? You're facing your own great replacement there. The entire Western world is experiencing this. This is a longstanding plan, I think, by certain groups that can be identified, I think. So Ireland, what's the, we can go through, what's actually going on over there with this, with the immigration crisis? I know you have a lot of crime related problems that a lot of areas have when you have mass migration.
Well, yeah, everything that we've predicted for years, I suppose, and have been called every name under the sun for saying that this is going to end in disaster is coming now to pass. And in Ireland, it's been so noticeable because I suppose up until, you know, the 1990s, we were a very monolithic, homogenous society. And, you know, if there was an African in town, like, everyone would be just staring, you know, it was amazing. We had a few Brits and a few Germans who were probably starting to escape the multiculturalism that had already happened in their countries, but they actually enhanced our society. They tended to go to the Western coast, the West Atlantic coast, and, you know, they've never in any way, they've only brought, I suppose, benefits. But the numbers were very, very small. We were predominantly 99.5% Irish up until really, as I say, the 1990s. And then really in the last, I mean, the last 2 years, the country has become unrecognizable. And I mean, they've been bringing them in by the truckload during the whole COVID scam, when a lot of people were stuck indoors, too frightened to go out. They were bringing them in by the thousands all through the night and into our ferry ports and into the airports. Of course, the airports didn't close, even though we weren't allowed to leave our homes. I did, obviously, but they were bringing them in from, you know, all over the world. And like, it's devastating. You know, parts of Dublin now are 90% migrant. I mean, our country is gone. It's gone. And Ireland fell late to the New World Order, but it fell hard. And I suppose the globalist elite discovered that in Ireland, they had a country that was very prone to corruption. Not always, obviously, but in the last 50 years, because the electoral system had, I suppose, become susceptible to rigging. And a lot of the Soros NGOs settled in Ireland. And, you know, we went through this appalling social engineering process, you know, where they transformed a very, very Catholic country into one of the most hard left, you know, degenerate dumps in the West. And it's horrific. It's a nightmare. But we have to, you know, our faith gets us through every day. But it's very difficult. We've had a lot of protests recently in the last couple of months. The problem is that, as with all of these apparent rebellions and uprisings, we have a long history of them in our country, but they get infiltrated at the top, the leadership, you know. And in most of them now in Ireland, these anti-migrant protests, they are being led by communists. And the police are highly corrupt in this country, and they concoct these false flag situations, you know, where migrant centres are attacked. Nothing to do with the, you know, so-called far right, but they're all staged, you know. So I have a lot of reservations about these protests. I don't know if it is the solution. I really feel we need to try and collapse the state. In a small country like Ireland, really, we don't really need too much government. And it's not like the United States, you know, we could get by very nicely without the government. The government only impedes us. It you know, rips us off every day in the form of outrageous taxation. So I'm trying to encourage people to just do what we did when we were taking on the crown 100 years ago. And really, you know, the way that we managed to gain some semblance of independence was by ignoring the crown and ridiculing the crown and ignoring everything they told us to do, rather than, you know, any armed rebellion failed. You know, we didn't get our independence through that. We got it by basically turning our back on the regime. So I think that is the solution in Ireland's case.
Yeah, the 1916 Easter uprising, of course, that's done during the Great War. And then the 1920s, you get your independence, like 1922. In Ireland, the Protestants in the north, Catholics in the south, and that's the partition.
Listen, that was really what we're discovering now about our history. You know, all of that was a big psychological operation. And you know, it was to create division between the Irish on the island of Ireland, but particularly in the bulk of the country, the 26 counties, as we call it, and the 6 counties of Northern Ireland, of Ulster, remained within the United Kingdom. but there was never any reason for this division because, well, you know, obviously there was a cohort of Protestants in the north that wanted to remain part of the United Kingdom, but, you know, really that should never have been allowed to continue. But there was all sorts of shenanigans, and I've no doubt there was Jewish influence there and Jewish money playing a role. But now, Timothy, what we've realized that we have a lot more in common with the Protestants in Northern Ireland than, say, the nationalists in Northern Ireland, so-called Catholics, because these Protestants have shown themselves to be extremely pro-life, mm-hmm. anti-gay marriage, and very Christian people. And even though, you know, they would be very uncomfortable with Rome, and they believe all of the propaganda about that, but, you know, we're willing, I think, to put our differences aside. And I just see that border now as invisible. It's a political border. It has absolutely no bearing on any of us now. You know, we can come and go into Northern Ireland, and they can come and go into the South, and, you know, we stick together now. So, but there was great, huge division at the time, and it's very similar to the division that there is now between the COVIDians and the anti-vaxxers. You know, the way they've divided families now is exactly as they did 100 years ago when the country was going to be split.
Yeah, it is interesting. She showed this, they call it intersectionality. With the left, where a lot of the people that will be counter-protesting, those protesting, say, mass migration to Ireland, are also advocates of LGBTQ rights and sort of the global homo agenda. And you can see how that's all part of the same agenda, where you deny the homogeneity and cultural identity of Ireland. At the same time, you infuse it with all these ideas, these global homo ideas, which are being injected. You say they, and of course, who they is, predominantly these are Jewish organizations, organized Jewry that are doing this. They're behind the mass migration movement. There are a few names, like within the, you'd think Ireland would have a Catholic government, and you look, some of these figures that are spearheading or this are Jewish figures, individuals, I guess, who are exploiting the relative liberal environment in Ireland to penetrate the government and use it for their, either for Zionist purposes or for their own ethnic agendas. And I think a decade ago, you had a guy in the Ministry of Justice who was changing the immigration laws in Ireland to facilitate the very problem that you're experiencing today. His name is Alan Shatter. He was Jewish. And there's also a couple of professors there that I've identified in Ireland who also advocate the same thing, claiming that Irish don't really exist. Ireland doesn't really exist as an identity. It just happens to be homogeneous, and that is subject to change. And they're advocating that all the same programs that you see throughout Europe and the United States, meaning diversity, you know, tolerance and these things, to sort of destroy the homogeneity of Ireland, its character, its nation, to sort of make it into just some sort of like unidentifiable cosmopolitan blob that could be exploited.
I mean, what they have done is they have made the young people despise what they believe to be the past in Ireland and despise their history in the same way that they've done this to the Germans. You know, I've been watching a lot of documentaries, reading a lot about Dresden, where today and yesterday were the anniversaries of the appalling firebombing of that magnificent, beautiful treasure trove of a city.
That's right, 7-8 years ago today.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, when you look at the Germans, and I know E. Michael Jones and yourself, you know, you're so eloquent in describing what has happened to the German people. But what has happened to the Irish is very, very similar. We've been both taught to hate our history, when in fact our histories are among the most glorious, really, and heroic in the world, you know. And Ireland was always known as the land of saints and scholars, and we were invaded, you know, by the Vikings and obviously the crown. And we constantly fought for the right to hold on to our Christian identity first and foremost. And, you know, many who came here became more Irish than the Irish themselves, as they said, because they adopted Christian principles. Of course, our saints brought the gospel to continental Europe and to England, St. Patrick, and then St. all of the saints that and the monks that were inspired by him, you know, and they helped to save the scripture, holy scriptures, and, you know, the Greek and Roman works, of phenomenally important works of literature. And the Irish monks were responsible really for saving them when Rome fell. And so we have the most extraordinary history, and we're Catholic, very, very Catholic. I mean, the two words, obviously, Irish Catholic. And I suppose in many ways we had a lot more in common with Spain and Italy and France. And, you know, the culture was more similar in many ways, and very traditional, and big families. Mass, the center of the week, and all of the Catholic sacraments being, you know, fundamental rites of passage, even up to today, to be fair, for children, like First Holy Communion, confirmation. So the media about 20 years ago, 20 to 25 years ago, started this anti-Catholic campaign here. Firstly, talking about sexual abuse within the church nonstop, night and day, horrific stories of paedophilia. And, you know, everyone was completely shocked to the core. This was certainly was news to me. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and I'd never, ever come across anything like that. But the media made it appear that this was, you know, wholesale, rampant in every religious organization, and most of it was lies. And they concocted an awful lot of fabricated stories, a bit like the people against God, against their heritage, against the faith of their fathers. And as a result, today we have a very degenerate young population, completely godless. And their lives revolve around, you know, the next drunken escapade, holiday, you know, football game. And they are just completely anti. It's very sad, but they are very, very anti-church and very anti-Catholic. And the mainstream media are responsible, utterly and totally. And they just churn out the most decadent pornographic, soft pornography, basically over the airwaves, in the way that, you know, Michael Jones describes what the Israelis have been doing to the Palestinians. And
sexual liberation as political control. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I mean, our constitution is Catholic, and we have in the constitution, there is a reference to the idea that women should be in the home, that they should not be forced through economic circumstances to leave the home, so that their children can have the best possible start in life, i.e. that their mother is with them and that they do not fall into the hands of the state. And but of course, you know, young women are told that this is very repressive, that you should farm your children out into industrial creches where they will be taught all sorts of weird 60 gender ideologies and turn into little cultural Marxists. And, you know, all of the wonderful instruments that we had in our constitution and in our culture to protect the family are ridiculed and seen as very old fashioned.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, Chris, the component or the role that the church sex scandal served in undermining, I guess, the confidence and the demoralizing Irish society, introducing corruption. The very same people that promoted the church sex scandal as a story were behind sort of the cultural war to corrupt the morals of Irish society. The same thing occurred here in the United States, really. This sort of was overblown church sex scandal, where they exaggerate or they emphasize it and they ignore, of course, other things going on, like the scandal of Hollywood and the culture of gender promoted by the Jews. In the United States, we had a movie called Spotlight that won the Academy Awards. You might have heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the Boston Globe Spotlight story that investigated the Catholic Church in the Boston Diocese, where basically over 50 years, 10 predator priests were identified. Of course, this time you had about 50,000 priests. So not many, considering, of course, far below the average in society in general, but nevertheless, the story was highlighted. And of course, the movie wins the Academy Awards. And the movie features Marty Baron, the editor of the Boston Globe. He came from Miami. He was a Jewish son of Jewish immigrants, and he's there to pass not judgment, but he's there to correct the Catholics in Boston. And in that movie, it's the Catholic culture and the insularity of Catholic culture which creates the scandal, not the overall corruption of society promoted by Jews, but the culture. And so, so that's talked about. And this is an important part in America.
Tim,
can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie kind of blamed the Catholic culture, the Catholic community, as opposed to the overall corruption of society, meaning you can't poison the well culturally from which the church draws from, then also turn around and blame the church for the corruption and these things. But John Paul II had come out against the Iraq war. And some people suggest that this scandal was kind of held in reserve until the proper time. And then the moment John Paul II comes out against the US invasion of Iraq, the story breaks, and basically undermine the credibility of the Catholic Church. And there, I think in Ireland, I think it was James Joyce who said that Ireland had too many priests. And the idea was that the Irish people suffered from a lack of proper, I think he was a fallen Catholic himself, but I think E. Michael Jones made the observation that Ireland, too often the people weren't indoctrinated properly, the doctrine of the church. So when a scandal hit the church, people identified with the priest himself. So when the priest sins, it's the scandal. And that undermines, people have nothing to fall back on, and they can't fall back on their doctrine, and they lose all, because they lose all trust in the church. And then once you no longer have the protection of the church, Google, HBO, Hollywood, global capitalism comes in and fills the void, and you have what you have today. Is that a fair criticism? I've heard that of Ireland.
Yes, it is. I think it is, because we were very Marian, a lot of Marian devotion in Ireland, that is very strong. And arguably, yes, it was a very strong faith, the emphasis being on faith. And one of the beautiful things that is happening now is that the Irish are learning about the Bible, and it's that I do put down to what is, the Christian Renaissance, I suppose, that's coming from America and also the UK. And I suppose as Catholics, the Bible doesn't really come into it, because we have all of the instructions we need from the magisterium and, and our catechism, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's really assisting an awful lot of Catholics to start reading the Bible, I think, and it's bringing them even deeper into their Catholic faith. So that's one thing. But, but I do still feel it's really a genetic thing with us, Timothy. I we are Catholic in our DNA, because our struggle to be independent was very much our struggle to be Catholic, because the crown wanted us to adopt Protestantism. And many people starved as a result and struggled. They refused to take the soup and adopt the Book of Common Prayer. So it's very much our identity. Even, atheists would say that they're cultural Catholics. I don't know what they mean by that, but they want to hold on to that identity. Why is that? Because the Catholic lifestyle is the one that offers the most happiness in this earth. and the next. Yeah. And I know growing up in a holy Catholic country, 99%, 100%, what it meant was it was incredibly safe. Everyone could leave their doors open at night. Women suffered yes, there was stuff going on, of course, as there always is, but it was minimal. Like, my generation grew up in a very safe country. You know, I suppose they were starting to introduce the discos and the nightclubs when I was growing up, but you know, you could walk home as a woman in, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. It was just so safe. And now you would be afraid to allow your teenage daughter out after dark. So very like the culture of a Catholic, holy Catholic country is also a very friendly culture.
It sounds like you're describing something like the Irish ethnic neighborhood in the United States, like in Philadelphia or Boston.
I'd say so.
Hard scrabble, so. There's poverty, but there's high trust and there's security. And there's... you're on sort of a spiritual terra firma, if you will. You kind of know your place in the universe, and there's not, although there's struggle, there's obviously frustration and pain in life, but you're ultimately you're happy because of your cosmology as Catholic.
Yes. Yeah. People were very moral. You know, they were very, very, they had a very strong sense of conscience and morality, and that there would be accountability. So that meant everything was so much easier. Business dealings were so much easier because you were less likely to be scammed. Life just was very, very easy. You know, like, it was a pleasure to travel in the country because, you know, we had wonderful guest houses and country hotels where you'd get the warmest of welcomes. And it was just like one big extended family in this country.
But you didn't have diversity.
We had no diversity. We were a big family. And we were
I know. First of all, you do have diversity. You have people with red hair, brown hair, blonde hair, blue eyes, brown eyes. I love this. And white people, actually, we actually change our color. We get tan and we get pale again.
Well, we never needed to use the word white, and I try to resist. You know, I say we're pink, in fact, but yeah. But we never, because you see, I know that is the game, and I totally agree with Dr. Michael Jones on that. You know, that it is a game that they want us to play.
Well, you're Duracit. They want a Duracit.
I agree. It's yes, very much so, very much so. So like the loss of that, you know, and now. What's happened, Timothy, is the service industry in Ireland now is basically, we're looking at mostly Eastern Europeans. Now, God bless them, but they've lived under communism, and communism doesn't exactly bring out the warmest in, you know, it doesn't bring out that friendliness in people. Mm-hmm. So now we've gone from being the friendliest country in the world to one of the most austere. Because you have these Polish and Lithuanians and goodness knows where they're from on the front of reception desks in hotels and in cafes. And it's just all monosyllabic. Yes. No. What do you want? It's devastating.
Yes, that is devastating. I mean, it's not trivial. It's what defines for decades, Ireland was in the United States. You go there. It was renowned for its friendliness and the people were talkative, they engage you, and they, you know, that's something you expect from someone who's a scholar and a poet, right? And now, yeah, you're right, it's terse, it's direct, you know, loses its identity and charm. Again, all for what? Why? Who made this decision? No one asked the Irish people, right? There was no referendum on this, right?
Oh, well, I mean, we were one of the few nations that voted against the EU. But they came back in one of the early referendums. The Irish said, no, we want to stay on our own. Thank you very much. We're an island in the Atlantic, and that's the way we'd like to remain, especially given that we had only really recently got our independence and we're getting on our feet. We had a fantastic agricultural industry that was, you know, among the most respected, best beef, best lamb, best pork. best dairy, and I would say in the world, you know, it's Irish lamb, Irish beef is renowned, world renowned. So we had an awful lot going for us. And then the EU came in and destroyed it. They held a second referendum, and I would say it was rigged. And I would also say that the recent referendums for the sodomite marriage, abortion, and children's rights were also rigged. And I can say this with quite a bit of experience, because I ran for election in my desperation in the last few years. I said, right, I'm going to have to put my foot in the political waters. And, you know, it was a nightmare. I wasn't able to hold a meeting. The police would shut it down. They'd send in Antifa, and Antifa would cause a riot outside, and the police would say, you have to shut down your meeting. And then my vote was completely rigged. I mean, we could see my votes disappearing at the polling centres and all sorts of shenanigans going on.
Yeah, that's
on.
Something that I think more people are familiar with now, especially with what was exposed with Twitter, Elon Musk acquisition of Twitter and the Twittergate files, they're calling it, the files where you have collusion between Twitter and other big tech, Google, they're coordinating with the Federal Bureau of Investigation to suppress speech and control the dissemination of information. They call it curating or moderating. It's just censorship. And again, you talk running for office, getting the word out, debating. Obviously, the election itself, it can be rigged in and of itself, meaning literally ballot stuffing or ballot curating or taking away votes or adding votes. That can be done very easily now, especially with mail-in voting or electronic voting or computer voting. But before that, you have the control of information. I know in very much the same way that Twitter and Google and big tech manipulated information going into our 2020 presidential election to affect the outcome, suppressing stories regarding Biden family corruption. Obviously, if the public isn't getting the information that it needs to make a decision on who to vote for, you don't have a democracy. This is not the democracy that they say we have. You don't have the free flow of information. The fourth estate, the media, isn't playing its role. It's providing information to the public by which the public decides who to vote for, who not to vote for. What came out of Ireland, what I understand, is Facebook and Google did a very similar thing with controlling what was said or who could say things on social media that had a profound impact on how people voted on those referendums. Am I correct? Did Google, for instance, Google and Facebook manipulated information in the run-up to those referendums to determine the outcome?
Oh, very, very much so. Very much so. And especially in relation to the abortion one, which was held in 2018. And so we only recently legalized abortion. Well, I will never say that abortion is legal, but, and actually, Timothy, like what we've discovered is the vast majority of Irish doctors will not carry out abortion, which is wonderful. Thank God. Nobody wanted abortion in Ireland. Nobody. Like we had a specific clause in our constitution stating that the unborn, the life of the unborn, would be protected. So there was absolutely no desire for it. And the Irish Times, which would be the equivalent of the New York Times over there, a really disgusting anti-Irish paper now, hard left, they concocted a story about an Indian woman in the run-up to the abortion referendum, and they claimed that she had been denied an abortion because of the abortion laws. And one of the wonderful things about having Catholic health service is that mothers got the best maternal health care, and Ireland was always rated in the top five of maternal health care, because what that meant was mother and baby were treated with equal, you know, love. But if there was any problem, you know, the mother's life obviously would be saved, but that didn't involve abortion. And that came from the culture of the nuns who established most of the hospitals in Ireland, the religious orders, and they were phenomenal places, spotless, and you know, they were dedicated to healing the sick, not using big pharma. But so they concocted this story anyway, and they got a lot of people up in a you know, complete lather over it that, oh, and I mean, the fact that she was Indian as well, like, at the time, I suppose we didn't really bat an eyelid about that, but it's quite telling. But this lady died. They claimed that it was because of the abortion laws. If the abortion law hadn't been in place, then her life would have been saved. Complete lies. And there was nothing in our abortion laws that would suggest that the baby's life must take precedence over the mother. Mm-hmm. And so they, with this and a couple of other anti-Catholic stories, they got it over the line. Also, there was serious George Soros funding of certain so-called human rights charities in Ireland, including Amnesty, to promote abortion. And it was night and day on the media, and as I say, nobody wanted it. I mean, this is the most unbelievable aspect. Nobody really wanted it. So we saw abortion as a sort of backstreet, really horrible act, and the idea that mothers could kill their unborn. Like, up until a few years ago in Ireland, that was inconceivable. And I think, excuse the pun, but I think even now most Irish women know that it is gravely immoral, and they're not taking to it. I don't believe that they're taking to it. They know that it's wrong.
Yeah, I guess they'll have to import doctors from Turkey or Syria to perform abortions.
Exactly. That's what they're doing. That's what they're doing. But even still, you know, any woman in her 30s whose mother, say, would be in her 60s or 70s, that mother, the grandmother, would have been reared in a Catholic culture. So, you know, I think it wouldn't sit comfortably with a lot of young Irish women.
Well, ironically, even now, of course, we're being told that Ireland, the birth rates are low now, right?
Completely down, like, they're, you know, disastrous.
Okay, so this is something that Ireland, high birth rates, high immigration rates, that was Ireland for a century, for 150 years, since the potato famine, so-called famine. We can get into that if you want to. It wasn't a famine, it was food expropriation. But what are you going to do? Food was expensive it was expensive abroad. You have to export it. That's what the market dictates, right? But
genocide. Genocide.
The idea, now they're saying, okay, so let's legalize abortion. Let's collapse the birth rates, introduce contraception, homosexuality, basically sterility in Irish society, then declare we don't have enough people, you have to import everybody. If the state had the Irish people's interest at heart, it's very easy to boost birth rates by promoting laws and policies that make it easier to have a family.
Absolutely. It's an absolute nonsense to suggest that we need to import people from Africa. I mean, we had a scenario a few years ago where hundreds of Irish nurses stood on the steps of the Sydney Opera House in Australia and said, give us a reason to come home. They wanted to come home. We're exporting, you know, our doctors, our nurses. Mm-hmm. I would have said highly talented people, but now, in light of what we've learned about COVID scam, they're clearly not indoctrinated, yes. But we don't want our young people to be leaving. And there was never any need, Timothy, for this. There was never any need. But I firmly believe that the powers that shouldn't be, the Jewish cabal that run this world, have had their eye on Ireland for a long time, because we refused to take a side in the Second World War. We were more aligned with Germany. Our founding fathers were supportive of the German National Socialist regime. They were supportive of Adolf Hitler, and they believed that it was important that the Jews were dealt with for once and for all, obviously in a humane manner, but they were very, very supportive of Germany. And you just scratch beneath the surface with Irish people, and they have this latent sort of suspicion of the Jews coming from their Christian heritage.
And so, they had seen the other side of British policy. I mean, most people in the United States, despite the American Revolutionary War and the British burning the White House in 1814, have a very benign view of Britain. And Ireland, Irish. I'm sorry?
You just broke up slightly there. Oh. Sorry. They have a
benign view of Britain. We share a common tongue, theoretically. So British influence in the United States, especially on the Eastern seaboard, that's the opinion that matters in the United States. The Midwest is just flyover country in the United States. They don't factor much in the policy. It's the policy that matters. And there's fun thing is, if you look at history, is sort of the convergence of British and Jewish power in the 19th century. And I always thought the British Empire was kind of folded into the Rothschild Empire in the 19th century through the magic of usury and compound interest. The financial power of Jews was greatly enhanced in the 19th century in Great Britain. And that's why you have something like the Balfour Declaration and how Winston Churchill himself, the Churchill family, was highly indebted to Jews. And that's when he took in the 1930s, he was bailed out by Jewish financiers, and he became anti-German at that point. They basically control the money supply. You buy up the politicians, and that's the basis of at least their direct political power. We can talk about how they control the narrative through their control of the media and culture and entertainment. I guess Ireland isn't exempt from that.
You see, it isn't at all. And that was the other thing. Like, we had very strong leagues of decency and abstinence movements, thanks to our priests. They kept pornography out. And, you know, they knew exactly who was bringing pornography into Europe, into continental Europe. And there was no pornography. There was none, you know, up until probably the 90s or even later. And so all of that, and, you know, even the cultural, like the music and the, you know, the swinging 60s came quite late to Ireland, you know, because a lot of my parents' generation were caught up in the changes happening in Vatican II, and many of them were devastated at what was happening to their mass and to their liturgy and to their traditions. So they were sort of more caught up in that in many ways. So everything was a bit delayed. And then when really, you know, the 70s and 80s got going, it was just like, well, then, you know, that's really when the decadence began. But
am I understanding most houses in Ireland didn't have television sets to the late 1960s?
Oh, yes. Yes. And we only had.
What a blessing of poverty for Ireland.
Who was it that said that having a TV in your room is like having a Jew in the living room?
Father Finney, an Irish Catholic priest.
He
was defrocked for saying that.
Oh, proper. He should be canonized. No, it was, I mean, it was like, it was just a very sort of rural, people say it was poor, but I believe it was very rich because people were very self-sustaining.
Doesn't that depend on what you value?
Yes, exactly. Yes. They didn't have a lot, didn't want a lot. You know, they had everything they needed, a little farm, and they had the means through which to grow food and, you know, like big, big families were reared in tiny cottages, you know, 15 children, no problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I would give really for us to go back, like if you saw what they are doing to our island at the moment, they are putting up these horrific Soviet apartment blocks everywhere. The prisons of the future, the slums. Mm-hmm. And Ireland was always were low rise. You know, we just had sort of maybe two-story semi-detached houses, but mainly cottages and and especially in rural Ireland. And now every field they can get their hands on, they're putting up. This is all being funded by American Vulture Capital, of course. Mm-hmm. And
Paul,
they're just
Paul Singer and
drawing Jewish capital.
Yes, it is Jewish.
Yes,
it is. I'm sorry. It is what it is.
Oh, it is. No, I shouldn't blame America. No, it. I mean, absolutely. And in the crash of 2008, Ireland fell the hardest with Greece, and we actually paid the highest per capita debt back because we had a very greedy class of developers here, highly corrupt, working with the politicians who got carried away, and the Irish people are still, they're going to be paying it back for generations, a debt that doesn't really exist.
Well, this is funny. Ireland has a history of that, because from what I understand is Irish independence was purchased, and it wasn't until the 80s that was paid off, when these families were paying off the, the descendants of the absentee landlords. And that kept, of course, that keeps Ireland poor to the extent that it's poor, right? People know it's poor, all this debt. But yeah, a trick was played on Ireland and Greece, lines countries where outfits like Goldman Sachs cook the books. Had Ireland borrow a lot of money. The state borrowed a lot of money in the name of the Greek people, the Irish people.
Yeah, you were saying Goldman Sachs cooked the books.
He cooked the books for Greece and Ireland. We heard about the debt crisis that happened, the European debt crisis.
The debt crisis was a nightmare.
The same time, it boosted Irish consumerism, and at the same time, changed your Irish culture and values with all that funny money that was borrowed. Apparently, Irish thought they were rich; they weren't. There was borrowed money.
They were suddenly like buying little one bedroom cottages for €1 million and thinking that they were worth that. They got completely carried away. They were buying apartments in Bulgaria. One, two, three, they were having all these foreign holidays and building extensions. And they got completely carried away because, they thought that this was the sign of a modern society and materialistic wealth.
And they stopped having babies?
They stopped having babies because they were so heavily in debt, and women had to go out and work all the hours, and the incentive just wasn't there financially. They couldn't afford it.
No, we call that liberated.
Yes, that's liberation. Yes, women's lib. Yeah. It's the exact opposite of liberation. And, again, like just two generations back, their grandparents, their grandmothers were having 10, 12 children. And, we all grew up with these enormous families. I know you did too, thanks to your Irish heritage. And that was a great security network, to know that you had such a large family and, you'd never be stuck.
You put it in monetary terms, it's estimated that the human body, a mature human body, healthy human body has $2 million worth of organs in it. So when you have a big family, you're multi-millionaire.
There you go. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but now that you say it.
What I'm saying is obviously the value of a human person, a developed moral human person, has something to offer. I think, Chris, we don't see we see everything in monetary terms, unfortunately. That's what we've been kind of engineered to think. And money isn't wealth. Money is a means of exchange. It can be a store of value for the accumulation or trade or distribution of wealth. But money itself isn't wealth. It's the corruption of the money supply. But it can certainly be weaponized to extract wealth, especially if it's fiat money and it's debt-based, which is what our current system is, And yes. Ireland has learned that. The United States is under that, with enormous debt. The government.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't recognize that debt. I think a lot of Irish people feel so overwhelmed by the state of the economy, the state of the country, the state of the political elite, that they just feel there's no way out of this. But I say to them, that debt is not our debt, and it's figures on a screen. It doesn't exist. It's not backed by any wealth.
Well, it's so, you're talking about trillions and trillions and quadrillions of debt that at some point, it's just the numbers on a screen.
And these houses, like they're giving, the average Irish couple now pays, to get a half decent house, they're paying more than €500,000 really to get a good house in Dublin. And this is just criminal. This hyperinflation has been created by, you know, we know who's doing it. Mm-hmm. And so all of that interest that's being paid, you know, that is illegal as far as I'm concerned. Well, we know it is. I mean, it's usury. It's so I would be saying, you know, if we can, I mean, I can only get through all of this knowing that there is a way out of it, that there has to be a future for Ireland, as there has to be for America and the UK. And
or aren't they giving, like, isn't the state providing housing for immigrants?
Oh, yeah. No, immigrants get housing. They get everything free, laid on. And they we've had, you know, this homeless problem again. Never, there was never any homelessness in Catholic Ireland. No homelessness, because there were always Catholic refuges, and there'd be a few down and outs. Maybe you could count them on the, like, Dublin's down and outs when I was growing up, you could count them on the fingers of one hand. They had their own name, like everyone knew their names. There were so few of them. And now, I mean, it's just a disaster. So we've a lot of our own people living in tents as a result of alcoholism and drug abuse, but they're never looked after. They have to live in the freezing cold, but the Ukrainians land in from Pakistan. And they are, you know, housed immediately, and everyone can come. And this is the funny thing. These Ukrainians, you know, they are Pakistanis and Indians. Most of them are not Ukrainian.
Ukrainians are Pakistani Indians. Oh, geez.
This is the unbelievable, like, that this is how insulting the whole thing is to the art. I mean, yeah, there's no shortage of Ukrainians coming. Like, if you go to an Irish post office now, they have everything in Ukrainian and English. So it's
but not Gaelic.
Well, no, to be fair, we do have everything in Irish there. Too, but but that's the other problem, Timothy, that we lost our native, like, you know, if we were speaking Irish as a people, then still, you know, this would not have happened. But we were very exposed as a result of the fact that we speak English as our first language. And, you know, again, what I would love to do is just have the airwaves completely in Irish, in Gaeilge, as we say. And, you know, because it is in the Irish people, we all have it, you know, it's in us. And to turn us back to an Irish speaking country, and then you'd be surprised how little interest the globalists would have in us, I'd say.
It is interesting, you know, these refugees, you know, Pakistani or Indians from Ukraine, or Ukrainians too, or Syrians for that matter. These are all refugees from these various wars that NATO, the United States, Anglo-American Tsar Empire, have fomented or started. You know, obviously the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, you know, if you look at that, obviously the United States government helped promote that by ignoring all normal diplomatic relations with Russia and just constant expansion eastward, and then blowing up the German pipeline. And Germany's an ally, supposedly. They're NATO. And it comes out the US, Britain, probably Norway, another NATO member was involved in blowing up that pipeline to separate Germany economically from Russia. But anyway, since 2011, the United States has been, and Israel have been involved in trying to undermine the Assad regime, creating a civil war in Syria, causing a diaspora of Syrian refugees into Europe. Gaddafi, Libya, when that government was overthrown, it created a catastrophe in Libya, and created this. Libya, actually, Gaddafi was keeping people from migrating, and he threatened, actually said, if you overthrow me, you'll get a brown wave into Europe. And it turns out that's exactly what NATO wanted. People don't realize this. People think NATO is a military alliance to secure Western Europe, or now Central Europe, or now Eastern Europe, keeps expanding, supposedly there to stabilize the continent. Actually, it's a force of destabilization. That's one thing that Americans, Europeans have to get into their head, is these organizations that are at very best obsolete because of what's happened in the past 30 years are institutions of destabilization and slavery. And they need to be scrapped. But you know, they're the source of the instability throughout Europe and in Ireland now, because they're the ones creating the wars and creating instability. They're devoted to chaos. I mean,
but Timothy, the point, like from an Irish perspective, is it's nothing to do with us because we are neutral. We've never got involved in any of these wars.
How dare you declare your independence?
How dare we? Again, that's another.
It's globalism, Gemma. What is globalism, right? No one is exempt.
No borders. Forget about borders.
Yes.
But again, you see, this comes from our Catholic ethos that we didn't want to get involved in these crazy wars. We knew who was running them. You know, I know that the Catholic founders of Ireland knew exactly what was going on. And we've been really sheltered as a result. And now, like, they're trying to sign us up to every bloody, they would have our young men heading off to war, and women, if they got their way. These criminals, like in government in Dublin, you know, they are throwing everything at it, and anti-Putin, and, you know, I mean, we've never taken sides in any international dispute.
Well, now that men can identify as women, do they bother with drafting women now? Because, you know, men can just identify as women. You have women in the military now. Did you ever see the movie Ryan's Daughter?
I don't know if I did. Because I'm not a big movie person, because I can't really stand Hollywood. So.
It's a beautiful movie. It's made in
1970. I know it is. Yeah, I probably saw it years ago.
It has Trevor Howard as the Irish priest. It's kind of the way you want your priest to be, as Trevor Howard. Reminds me of the idea of the old kind of grizzled, tough Irish priest. He's the moral anchor of the town. He's one instructing Rose, who has who falls in love with the older teacher, Robert Mitchum. Then has an affair, and that's the story. It's very sad. It's all takes place during World War 1916, and there are British soldiers there, and they don't want to be there. The Irish don't want them there. They're just victims of circumstance, like most people on this planet. We don't control anything. They're just victims of circumstances. Mm. There's this one line in there. There's one of the great line is where Rose is suspected as being the informant, and the town, they're shaving her head, and they're about to strip her in public, and the priest steps in and stops it. And the guy says, "You wouldn't be so tough if you weren't wearing that collar." And he goes, "That's what it's for." And they back off. But there's a scene in it.
To have priests like that now.
I know, that's what it's for. And he gets ready to punch him. That's that's what you want to see. But there's a scene in I think Robert Mitchum, the teacher who plays the middle-aged teacher, coming back from England. This is during World War One, and she meets him at the beach, and she's enamored with him because he's sophisticated and educated. That's the source of her love for him, initially. And he goes, "What's going on in London?" He goes, "You know, Rose, they've banned Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart." She goes, "What?" "Yeah, they don't play, the Philharmonic, the London Philharmonic isn't playing Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart." He goes, "Well, that's crazy." He goes, "Yeah, that is crazy. I suppose if we had our own government, it'd do crazy things too."
Oh, deja vu all over again.
That's a neat line. So he's just kind of just insane, you know. But anyway, I don't know why we meant me go off on that tangent. But whenever I think of Ireland, I think of Ryan's Daughter. So anyway.
I think a lot of people do. A lot of people do. But I'm not into films at all. Full stop.
But I mean, it's crazy because, again, what they do, Ireland just wanted, it just wants to be left alone, and they won't leave it alone. And the only problem is you don't have people in government who represent the Irish people anymore. They're the same problem. You have probably the same problem we have here. The political class is completely bought off or blackmailed or both.
Completely. Right? Yeah. They despise the Irish people. I mean, we've had a gay Indian who calls himself Prime Minister Taoiseach, as we say here.
And
he's a complete juvenile. You know, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. And most of them are like they're like teenagers. You know, most of them are quite young, and they came out of nowhere.
Was it McDonald, the pro-choice, pro-abortion president back in the 90s? Was her name McDonald?
Robinson, Mary Robinson.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Mary Robinson. Yeah.
She would be hardcore. Yeah. She was that, like, brought about the beginning of the the change or the sort of anti, you know, the feminazism, I suppose. Nazism isn't the right term now, but
I don't want to blame the women, but some of these women politicians are the worst because they're just doing something they're not supposed to be doing. But then again, the men are pretty bad too. So I hesitate to say that, but the men are feminized. So the men think like women, but Sinn Féin. I'm sorry. The leader has condemning the anti-immigrant protest that they're.
Sinn Féin. Really, you know, we're now really understanding that Sinn Féin is just a wing of MI5, CIA. They were created, the modern version, not the original version, who were patriots, but the modern version are basically, you know, Marxists, hardcore Marxists and globalists and Soros funded and anti-Irish. So it's a very clever trick, you know, but thank goodness people are realizing this now. And that because, you know, the next obvious step would be to elect them because, you know, up until all of this madness, people would have thought, well, Sinn Féin are very nationalistic. Mm-hmm. They'd have to be, you know, the IRA and all of this. But all of that was a complete con, you know, the MI5 invented the modern IRA in order to keep the troubles going in Northern Ireland, to keep the to justify have, you know, holding on to the six counties in Northern Ireland, to keep the war going, you know,
strategy of tension, as they say.
The police state in Northern Ireland, you know, was very important to the UK, very valuable to it. And so, but thankfully, a lot of it has gone now. But the people have been very traumatized by it all. So, but Sinn Féin are an absolute joke. And, you know, they are terrorists. I mean, there's no question. They have this horrible terrorist past. You know, they were working hand in hand with MI5 to bomb English cities and blow up innocent civilians, and they were never Irish or Catholic.
Mm-hmm. It was Gerry Adams was the leader. That's the name I remember.
Yeah, just 90s. a puppet, a traitor. I mean, these people were all controlled, Timothy, a long time ago. They would have got dirt on them, and through that they were able to control them. And that's the case with nearly all Irish politicians. They're all either blackmailed, a bit like the ones in Washington, compromised or cowards. But most of them are compromised somewhere along the line. And that's how they do it, you know. But also they're psychopaths. And, you know, they despise the people, the Irish.
There's a negative vetting system where I think it's the Greek term is kakistocracy. It's the rule of the worst. And what you do is through blackmail, bribe, they can be vetted for the worst traits, you know.
Yes. I mean, we keep being told that immigration is going to enrich our culture, you know, which is so insulting to Irish people. But all we see around us is migrant crime and, you know, crazy behavior that we've never seen the likes of in Ireland.
This is something that's obviously predictable, and they know this. They know the very tension that you're lamenting, decrying, calling out is they want that. That's one thing we don't get in their heads is the reason why George Soros will fund the campaigns of prosecutors in the United States, district attorneys that are dedicated to not going after real crime, is they want life to become difficult. They want the high crime, they want the tension and all that. And that's the goal of the Open Society Foundation. And it is not just Soros, as we use as a term, this is a whole structure now. The same thing is the problems with immigration you're seeing in Ireland. It's more concentrated perhaps, but people, well, in here in the States, if you're in Lewiston, Maine, or in Minneapolis, St. Paul area in Minnesota, or various towns throughout the country, our federal government has been flying in by the tens of thousands immigrants from all over the world, not just Mexico, which is more adaptable to the United States, that's part of the United States history, but they're coming from deep further south and all over the world, Africa. How does Africa how do Africans end up in Mexico? There's a network here. There's organizations, NGOs that are heavily funded with funny money, and they're being used. It's weaponized migration. It's a form of of warfare, psychological warfare, and they've been caught doing it. You know, illegally flying people into cities and all that, and just dumping.
I know. It's absolutely terrifying. It's terrifying for Americans. It's terrifying for Irish people. And I would be worried about the protests that are happening, because I think that does feed into the chaos that they want, you know, that you've spoken about. And when they put in people who are going to be violent towards police and violent towards migrants, you know, that just gives the state what it wants. And I don't think there's anyone in Ireland who's anti-migrant but violent. You know, we're just not like that.
Well, isn't the violence, the initial violence is the introduction of these people into the country without the will of the public. I mean, that's in itself is an act of violence. It's an invasion, you know.
It's an invasion.
Yeah.
It's an invasion. Yep. We have no say over our country anymore. Like, that's what democracy, I know that word really just means mob rule. But the whole idea is that these people in government are our servants, and the police are there to protect us. But everything has been inverted, and now we are completely irrelevant. We have no say over anything that happens in our local parishes, in our villages, our towns, our suburbs. We have absolutely no say.
Why should Ireland have any immigration?
None. We shouldn't have any.
Yeah, I think Africa is 400 times the size of Ireland.
Yep. Yep. 370 or something like that. Yeah. And it's crazy. I mean, I think most of these people know they've no business being here. And that goes for, you know, I include in that the Eastern Europeans who have come. They're all coming to exploit our country, and they've abandoned their own countries. And it's different. I think it is different in America. I'm not talking about the current immigration, but the past immigration. But I mean, what I would be saying that the only immigration that there should be into Ireland is that of Irish people who were forced to leave due to economic circumstances.
Yeah, the Irish diaspora.
Yes. I mean, the children of the diaspora have a right to know their home.
A right of return? Could we call it a right of return?
We'd love to have them back.
Shall we dare?
Yeah, we'd love to have them. Absolutely. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we were all reunited. And there is, you know, Ireland is still, we have a lot of green fields, thank God, but we want to leave it like that. You know, that's the beauty of Ireland, that it was a very peaceful, tranquil, rural place. And we want it to be like that. We don't want the big cities. We don't want, you know, the high rise and the big cities and the skyscrapers. We don't want any of that. You know, that's great when we go to America, we enjoy it, but that's not what we want.
Well, yeah, that's true diversity, I guess you could say, right? The irony of globalism, and they invoke diversity and tolerance, but they're imposing one model for the entire world, destroying any diversity there is, if you know.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, it's just everything is just wrong. Everything.
Well, also, America is far different than Ireland and also the European countries. United States is not an ethnic state, whereas Ireland, you could say, was sort of an ethno. Wouldn't call it a confessional state, but it's obviously Catholic, and that's its identity. United States, well, the United States. What is the United States? What was the United States? As an American, I'm uncomfortable thinking about it. But if anything, I'm a victim of circumstance. Not a victim, you could say a beneficiary. My mother never would have met the father for the misfortunes of other people. that's history. That's how it plays out. But the idea of America, of course. It's a different political model. It's not a unitary state. I think the future of America is probably some sort of dissolution and separation and local government, more localized system, at least something or reversion to its original idea, perhaps. But the idea is Ireland, obviously everyone knows Ireland has, it's a Catholic country, therefore. And if you start importing non-Catholics, you no longer have Ireland anymore.
No, you don't. But also, I have to say that our ethnicity and, you know, our DNA, like we, it is very, like it goes back a long way. The mm-hmm. thing about the Irish, we're very rooted in this country. We, you know, we go back for generations. We know all of the family name. Like I knew instinctively that you were Irish because of your surname. Mm-hmm. So we have this incredible heritage, and we do. It's something that is very. It's very unique, I suppose, to a lot of the countries of continental Europe and the UK. But Ireland is special because we just feel so rooted in this land. Like I know that most of my ancestors came from here going back over hundreds of years. So, you know, I could go to any graveyard in the country and probably find somebody who would be related to me, distant relation. And if I go to, say, a county in the north where my father's from, Donegal, which is part of Ireland, part of the 26 counties, you know, a lot of people will say to me, well, which O'Dohertys were they? And they will wait. They will establish exactly what branch, you know, everyone knows everyone. And like, this is what, like, I am heartbroken at the idea. And this sounds really racist, but you go into our graveyards now and you're starting to see like Arabic names and Polish names. And that I actually feel very upset when I see that.
Because, well, your country's being taken. Well, your country's being taken away from you.
It's been taken.
You shouldn't even have to articulate that emotion. I'm sorry. It's understandable.
I actually squirm when I see it. Squirm, and I feel like it's so wrong. It's so wrong. I want our graveyards to have Irish family names there, and for them to be places where Irish people are buried. In the same way, you know, like, I know it does sound sort of petty, but it's devastating because with such a tiny population, it's going to happen so fast. And we already are a minority in many Irish towns now. So we will be a minority in our own country by 2030.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you've seen a similar thing occur like in Sweden, another country with a small population being inundated.
Yeah.
And having a very similar problem with crime. And again, this is intended. You know, and again, another group that's very vulnerable because of its, you know, conditioning of the past 60, 70 years to this.
Yeah. Devastating. I mean, they were way ahead on the old, liberation, I suppose. We were being very.
Yeah, the feminism kicked in the 60s there. Big time, much more than it did in the United States.
It did. The family breakup. Yeah.
And you had sort of this, Swedish socialism, which in a homogeneous situation may seem to function because you have high trust, people have a stake in it. But I would also argue that it also sets in motion the demoralization, you know, smaller families and the demographic decline winter that they're facing, which then opens them up to being taken over when you have malicious NGOs that are literally shipping in by the hundreds of thousands people from North Africa, the Horn of Africa, into Sweden, a natural place for people from, you know, from Horn of Africa to go to like a cold place like Sweden, right? That's where you put them. Seemed like a natural place for people from Nigeria or Libya or Syria is Ireland, right? Because the environment is so similar.
Oh yeah, it's so similar. Well, that's the other thing. I do feel that a lot of them, you know, an Irish winter is not like we love it. I love the winter here because it's very manageable, but it wouldn't be really for a lot of people, especially people coming from these, you know, African countries. And you would have to wonder, like, what are they doing here? You know, it's not that easy a country to live in if you're not Irish. And I think a lot of them go out of their minds. You know, that's why we see
something happen like in the United States with like Minneapolis. You had like 60,000 Somalis dumped there. People of Somalia dumped in Minneapolis, which are these people, Scandinavians that settled the land in the 19th century. And it was a liberal, the way that Scandinavians are, but it was high trust, orderly law and order. Now they have a terrible crime problem, like the Mall of America. And because maybe they can't make any sense of it, but the oligarchs that made this decision are getting exactly what they wanted, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They look on a map and they say, look, it's too white. Let's spice it up a bit. That's literally how they think, you know?
Well, it's this Kalergi plan, isn't it? It's the Jewish revenge.
Yeah, that's not a conspiracy theory. He wrote a book. And he was funded by the Warburgs and the Rothschilds. These are pretty big players in geopolitics, from what I understand.
Oh, well, I mean, they've admitted it, haven't they? They've admitted it countless times that this is their plan. And
he literally said the plan was to cause miscegenation throughout Europe.
Absolutely.
And bring it under American domination, which was Jewish controlled.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that, you know, Nazism could never happen again. This was their argument.
Well, there you go. Any assertion of identity, cultural identity, or nationalism based on those white ethnic lines, German, be it German or Irish, is suspect because of Hitler and that narrative. Yeah.
Yeah. But I have taken the Hitler narrative by the horns recently, in the last year. And, you know, I was probably the most high profile person in Ireland doing that. The only person really in terms of anyone with social media profile. And I am quite surprised at how Irish people have taken to it. And they
seem there a Holocaust memorial in Ireland? Do you have a museum?
There is a museum. There's a museum. All right. Yeah. Yes.
Now in Tel Aviv, if I go to Israel, is there a memorial or museum for the Irish Holocaust?
No.
Potato famine? Another. Okay.
No.
Why not?
I don't know. Because more people died, for sure. Millions more. Millions more. No, it's funny that, isn't it? But no, Israel's problems are nothing to do with us whatsoever. And we, you know, I mean, like there's very, very, very few Jews here. Very few. So, but it's because we kept them out. And there was, I think it is true to say that there was after the Second World War, there was, it was basically the case that they could not come in unless they converted to Christianity. Mm-hmm. They didn't feel welcome here anyway, because, you know, we were staunch Catholics. So we haven't had that, but of course, we haven't had their presence here, but of course they've really been here all along in the form of the international banks and the big tech and big pharma, who have put a lot of their headquarters here in the last few years.
Google and big pharma and the European Union.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of like Google, Twitter, Facebook. They all have their European headquarters in Dublin. Pfizer. You know, Pfizer is moving most of its operations to Dublin. They have a huge numerous plants here already, all around the country. And Big Pharma is just in every single Irish town now. So, and again, you see, because the Irish have embraced debt, they want to be up to their necks in debt. So they need these jobs with these horrible companies that are making poisonous vaccines.
They're killing them.
That are killing them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a clever scam, you know, because they say, oh, all the employment that they're providing, it's fantastic. But it's very, very toxic. This, you know, I mean, I would love for nothing more than for them to shut up shop and leave tomorrow, which I think a lot of them will go when the truth comes out.
Well, this is, something that, over the long haul, something like usury and compound interest, how it brings these things. Eventually, it brings catastrophe. In Ireland itself, the potato famine, the potato blight, which led to the famine, because from what my understanding is, what happened was the Irish were put on a diet of potatoes because the absentee British landlords were exporting the other food to make money and pay the debt that they owed to their Jewish creditors, because they were building these huge landed estates in the 19th century. And so the Irish were made to suffer so they could make the interest payments on their loans. And it was that point that families like the Rothschilds and other Jewish families were able to gain a certain amount of leverage over British society, integrate into the British establishment. And it was that point that you got something like what we call the 30 Years' War, the Second 30 Years' War, the two wars against Germany in the 20th century to destroy, to get control of the continent, to keep the continent from economically aligning. And we're seeing that play out today with what's going on in Ukraine and the economic warfare, which is primarily targeting Germany, German industry, depriving it of energy. So we're funny how history just keeps, if not repeating, echoing.
I most Irish people would not know that, Timothy, yeah. About the fact that the English landlords were up to their necks in Jewish debt. Mm-hmm. And that is why the Irish had to be starved. I heard you talking about that with E. Michael Jones, and I thought it is so interesting because I wasn't aware of that. You know, I knew that they were in debt, but I hadn't made the connection with
it. That's the inexorable and sort of the insidiousness of usury and debt.
Yeah. Now,
what it does is it forecloses it. It's a hidden coercion into the system because it's not sustainable. It's inorganic. Again, it's something written on a ledger book. It doesn't really exist, which is why historically it was banned because people knew its long-term corrosive effect. Although it could produce the appearance of short-term wealth and of course allow some people to amass huge riches, it's unnatural because money does not create anything. It's not wealth in and of itself. And that's what the Merchant of Venice is all about in these things. But we see today, I made a joke about the tragedy in the Ukraine. And I was texting some friends, well, rest assured, despite all the suffering in Ukraine, the West will be blessed with more than a few really attractive Ukrainian women who can then go on OnlyFans and sell themselves online. And I'm saying that as a joke, but I'm not saying it like it's funny. I'm saying this is what happened in Weimar Germany. People become desperate and they do things they wouldn't otherwise do. They don't even know they're doing it because their options are limited. And they become desperate. And you know, they resort to prostitution, which happened in Germany. It's happening in the United States now. We see it now benignly, like with what girls do online. It beats working in a factory, you know. And this is what happens when you worship mammon. You forsake God and you sell your soul. And that's what Ireland did. That's what the United States, well, did that a long time ago. Our official religion is mammon. We don't have, you know.
Yes. I was just looking at some black and white footage of Dresden earlier today in the 1940s, and the women were so elegant, beautiful, modest, and the men were so perfectly dressed, and everything looked so perfect, even though it was in the middle of the war and they knew what was coming, probably, although they didn't suspect Dresden would be bombed because it didn't have any military infrastructure. And you just wish you could go back to that Europe.
Well, you know, what Dresden wasn't military. It was iconoclasm. They had to destroy that city because they had to psychologically decapitate the German people. And you do that by destroying these cities that are 1,000 years old, right?
Correct.
Psychological war. I'm sure the people in Dresden at the time didn't see the psychological warfare. They were being incinerated by the tens of thousands. But for Germany itself, the bombing campaign was psychological warfare.
And they're not allowed to talk about it. If they talk about it, they're called Nazis and they're jailed. Mm-hmm. They're not allowed to talk about the pain that they feel over Dresden. They're not allowed to even feel pain. They're just supposed to feel guilt.
And keep writing those reparation checks.
Yeah.
That are cashed by somebody. Apparently somebody cashes them. They don't really exist, but somebody cashes those checks.
Oh, yeah. For sure. But the German taxpayer feels it in his monthly paycheck.
Well, we see it today, that psychological war, because the guilt of the Germans has been sort of spread throughout the entire West. Because if you do express any ethnic pride or identity, especially in context of opposition to mass immigration and being overwhelmed or being replaced, you are called a Nazi. You know, that's the trick.
Yeah, but you see, that never worked here because we were the little island who kicked the crown out, you know? And so we had every right to bask in our national identity. And that was quite unfortunate, I think, you know, because the rest of Europe was being lectured, you know, about don't have this nationalist sentiment, but you can't take it away from the Irish because of what we achieved, mm-hmm. you know, even though the crown never really left, but, you know, there was an appearance of a departure. And we were allowed to celebrate our independence and all of that. So it just, like, the idea that the Irish could not be allowed to celebrate their nationalism. We have a chief justice in the Supreme Court of Ireland now. He's an absolute disaster. But he recently said that he was concerned about aggressive nationalism sweeping across Europe. And coming from an Irish chief justice, that is just, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And it's very, very scary, you know. And this man mm-hmm. is from Northern Ireland. He's a nationalist from Northern Ireland. So, you know, we should all love our national identities. It's what makes us so interesting. Our culture is so different and unique and beautiful. And they've destroyed it. But it will come back. It has to, doesn't it, Timothy?
Yeah, because it's nature. It's the natural course of things. And everything they do is against nature. Just in the process of fighting nature, you create a whole lot of misery and destruction. But nature does reassert itself, yes.
You know, it does, the natural order.
And like I said, you also understand, I guess we're getting kind of long in this interview, kind of over an hour and a half, is ultimately they're evil and their plan goes against God's plan. And of course, God has his own time in this. And you have to have the faith that ultimately God's will win out, as it certainly will. Just in the meantime, there's a lot of, you know, I guess, struggle and perhaps martyrdom and sacrifice has to be made. And that's something that's not new, I guess. The Irish people know that. At least they should know it. Remember it.
They should, but I suppose they're being trained to forget their history. But yeah, I think they will. They will. You know, they're very proud of being Irish. That's one thing I would say most Irish people feel, a sense of pride that they're Irish. And so I think when the chips are down, they will fight for their country. But they have to lose a lot more. You know, they have to give up all of the trivia that they're involved in and the drinking and the godless nature of their lives. And they have to go back to God, and then they will save their country.
Yeah, you need, unfortunately, this is just, I have children, I don't want them to suffer. But in order to get on the right path to correct things, you need to be a chastening, a punishment, if you will, to remind people, a crisis. And that's you see that throughout history. And people, as long as they're comfortable, they're entertained, they're not going to be moved to do anything, and won't be alerted to it or aroused. And what you're seeing now, I think, is what they call it, the great noticing at first, which precedes action, I guess. And then you have to develop some form of political agency to fight it. And that's the toughest thing, is because they control all the means of communication and money and these things that are able to mobilize resources. But it is telling that something like your newspaper, your podcast, people's podcasts, are such a threat to people that the system has to come down so hard on them to suppress the truth. So there's hope there, you know. So
yes, there is. No, there is definitely. And you know, we have to remain optimistic and you know, go back to what is most important, and that's our faith. That's the only way we will win this. The only way.
And the gates of hell shall not prevail. So
no. So, you know, it's just, as you say, you know, suffering is definitely, we have to embrace the suffering, because mm-hmm. suffering will lead us to victory and, you know, to a sense of that we have a future as a country, as a nation. You know, that it's the only way. People have to embrace it and not be afraid of it. And in their suffering, they will find great strength and great mm-hmm. solace. And great joy. You know, real happiness comes from adversity. That's what, yes, I've discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's true in life in general. Yeah. Accomplishment comes from adversity. You know, so it's true in our personal lives and true in the lives of nations. And civilizations go through these things, like, you know, Christendom sprung from the collapse of the pagan Roman Empire. And that's a lot of centuries, a lot of lives, you know, a lot of peasants having babies and these things, and life went on. And so the first thing is you don't despair in these things. And at the very least, things are very interesting. So you have no excuse to be bored in our time. So
no, very interesting times we live in. Very interesting.
They say it's a curse. But so, well, Gemma, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for giving me the time to talk about what's going on in Ireland. And my best wishes to all of the Irish diaspora out there. I'm sure you have a large audience with Irish roots.
Thank you. It's always nice to have someone with a nice, charming Irish accent on.
Oh, I don't know about that, but thank you.
Do you find American accents charming?
I do very much.
Interesting. So. Okay.
No, what Americans have done for us all in the last few years, you know, you've led the charge in this awakening. And, you know, I just am eternally grateful to so many of you for helping everyone to waken up. You know, it's been phenomenal. So, even though America seems to be at its lowest phase or moment in history, in fact, you know, you've shown so much strength and resilience, and you've brought Christianity back to Europe in many ways too, which is fascinating.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's very gratifying. Thank you.
It's true.
Because I don't know if I can take, I don't know how much credit for that I can take, but
I'm sure.
So, there are, I think there are like 30, like close to 40 million Irish Americans. So
something like that.
So,
yes.
If they can, embrace that Irish Catholic identity, just think how much power they're. So, well, Gemma, yes. I had you on for long enough. I want to thank you. I know it's getting late over there. Get some rest. You gave me a lot of time tonight. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much, Timothy. And we'll talk again, I'm sure.
Where can the best place for people follow your work?
GemmaOdoherty.com, and I'm also on Getter, which is a sort of a MAGA platform, but they're very nice. They let me live stream.
Okay, great.
And I've gone back on Twitter, but I'm being shadow banned. And on BitChute is fantastic as well. So that's really it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link.
Great stuff. Okay. Thanks a million, Timothy.
And take care. I guess we're coming into Lent. So there you go.
Well, we are. Exactly. I love this time of year. I just love it because we have St. Patrick's Day, of course, coming up as well. And they're trying to do a transgender job this time around. And full-blown degeneracy. So there's going to be a big backlash against that, which will be great. Yeah.
Yeah. Chutzpah is always their downfall. So
it is.
Good night, then. So much. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night, Tim. Take care.
Good night. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Tremendous.
should he lie down?